Okay, we'll call the meeting to order, the Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Committee. And start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine. Representative Dean. Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Grossel.
Here.
Representative Howe.
Present.
Representative Lohmer.
Here.
Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger.
Ready to serve.
Representative O'Neill. Representative Pinto. Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Zerwas.
Okay. Have a motion for approval of minutes of January 19th. Representative Neuberger.
So moved.
Oh, that's right. You weren't here. I'm sorry. I have to pick somebody up.
So moved.
Representative Lohmer. Representative Lohmer moves the minutes of January 19th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Today we have up first Private Detective and Protective Agent Services Board Overview, Mr. Greg Cook. Go ahead and begin, sir, with your name and title.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Greg Cook, and I am the Executive Director of the Board of Private Detectives and Protective Agents. It is my agency's responsibility to regulate and provide oversight to the private investigative and security industry here in Minnesota. Our agency reports to and works at the direction of the board. The board was formed in 1974. There are five members of the board. One represents the protective agents. One represents the private detectives. One represents the Department of Public Safety, and we have two public members. Agency staff consists of my administrative assistant, Shauna Johns, and myself. I do need to note that I have a temporary part-time worker on board for a few months. His name is Greg Sepperon. He was an intern with the Fusion Center that he took on to help with some technical and analytical projects. I consider our license holders our clients. Along with our license holders, our stakeholders include law enforcement, government agencies, businesses, training providers, and the public. These are the entities who we deal with every day. These are our core functions. As a regulatory agency, it is our job to ensure that those applying for a license are qualified, as well as making sure that those that already have a license are meeting statutory requirements. There are several different components, a couple of which I would like to highlight today. The one question I receive frequently is, what is the length of time it takes to process an application? Per statutory guidelines, processing applications is an extensive procedure. The governor has instructed all agencies to streamline those types of procedures. This includes removing red tape, making the process easier to understand, and processing applications in a timely manner. The balancing act is making sure we are only licensing qualified individuals and holding them accountable while operating at a level of efficiency that allows the industry to operate smoothly, grow, and create jobs. Last time I came before this committee, I reported to you that our agency went from an average application processing time of 12 to 14 months in 2012 down to 3 to 4 months in 2014. Through our streamlining efforts and addition of staff, I'm happy to report that now we have the application process down to 30 to 60 days. We would actually be able to process them more in the 30-day range, but there's a statute that requires a 20-day posting notice of an application, which sometimes causes an overlap with our board meetings. Renewals are an equally important function. If a license holder does not have an up-to-date license, the result is they may lose insurance coverage, lose contracts, lose business, and employees lose jobs. Our agency works with the license holder in order to ensure the renewals are complete so they can avoid these situations. This reduces contingencies and penalties to license holders as well. Another statutory responsibility is ensuring the license holders and their employees are receiving qualified training to meet their continuing education requirements. Per statute, license holders and their employees must attain 12 hours of initial pre-assignment training and 6 hours of continuing education every year after that. Armed guards must receive an additional 6 hours specific to weapons, alternate use of force, first aid, and CPR. This includes annual certification on the firing range for those who carry firearms. We currently have certified 163 training providers and 1,145 approved courses that are renewed every 2 years. So you can better understand the industry, I'm displaying some of the services our licensed private investigators provide. A common misconception is that they only follow around cheating spouses. This is not the main source of income for the industry. As you can see, other types of services, elder abuse investigations, identity theft, cybercrime, insurance fraud, and locating missing children are all types of services you don't hear about as often. These services requested by and a benefit to the public, businesses, and government entities. On the security side, these services augment law enforcement. You have probably heard the labels rent-a-cop when describing private security. An overwhelming majority of our licensed private investigators and protective agents are current or retired law enforcement and military veterans. They are well-trained, qualified, and professional. What the public do not always realize is that private security assists in providing essential public safety services. Nationally, there is a 3-to-1 ratio of security to police officers, 13-to-1 in downtown Minneapolis. Private security is having an increasing role with the deterrence and prevention of terrorism. Frequently, they are finding themselves in the position of first responders. Private security assists law enforcement in submitting suspicious activity reports for further investigation. Private security contracts include not only local, state, and federal critical infrastructure accounts, but also private utility company facilities as well. This chart displays some statistics for the past couple of years. One subject from this chart I would like to highlight is unlicensed activity. This is a serious public safety and consumer protection concern. Reports received by our agency reflect that some of these individuals and business entities are providing security services, sometimes armed, and investigative services without verification that they are qualified. Being qualified includes ensuring they have a clean criminal background, have the required 6,000 hours of experience, are properly trained, understand the law, are financially responsible for liabilities, are not taking advantage of their clients, and making sure they are in compliance with paying taxes. Here are some of the stats regarding those that actually do go through the proper procedure. Since 2012, we've gone from 282 to 349 license holders, which is a 24% increase. The number is broken down further into 213 licensed private investigators and 136 licensed protective agents. Please note that the number of license holders is deceiving. A very important number to know is these license holders employ over 9,000 people, up from 8,000 the last time I presented to you. This is the number of individuals our agency actually regulates. Our agency has to verify the background check, training, and ID issuance and respond to inquiries for each of those 9,000 employees. In regard to our budget, these are probably smaller numbers than you're used to seeing. Our agency has appropriated $189,000 annually. All revenue received is deposited in the general fund. This includes revenue received from application fees, renewal fees, officer change fees, penalties, and administrative fees. We currently do not charge any fees for the certification of training. This is currently what is being charged for licenses. It is $1,000 to $1,900 for a private detective license, depending on your individual or corporate. It is $800 to $1,800 for a protected agent license, and renewals are roughly around half of that, depending on how many employees they have. In closing, I do have some good news to report. Previously, I was operating utilizing interns and temporary part-time workers. Last year, I was appropriated enough funds to hire a full-time administrative assistant. I've been very fortunate to be able to hire Shauna Johns for this position. She has done and continues to do a fantastic job. Much of our accomplishments are due to her hard work and dedication to the position. With an admin now in place, our agency has reached an elevated level of efficiency. We have wiped out a backlog. Tasks that took several months, such as processing of applications, officer changes, and training certifications, are now done within 30 to 60 days. We have reduced and revised our application forms from an extensive packet down to a couple of pages. We have developed a detailed and easy-to-understand instructions for applicants and those license holders renewing. Inquiries are responded to in a timely manner. We have implemented an internal controls program, and our agency is much more organized. We've been able to move forward on important smaller projects such as updating and revising an inadequate website. And we are currently conducting regional meetings with license holders. That is all I have for you today. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to hopefully educate some of our newer members, as well as provide a refresher for those that I presented to you before. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions at this time.
Okay, Director Cook, thank you. Representative Howe has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Cook. I just got a couple of questions. One is, what do you mentioned the 20-day public posting. What do other surrounding states, or what do other states require, and why do we have a 20-day public posting at all?
I actually do not know what the other states require regarding that, but I could find that out and get back to you later on that.
Sure. And then I guess the other question is, as I look at the number of services that require this type of a licensure, who determines what services fall under this? Do we add services under this? Who does that? And what other occupations? I mean, I would have to believe that some of these are coming up all the time. And do we add some, or do we just determine that because we think this is a good fit, we have you fall underneath this statute?
Director Cook.
Mr. Chair, Representative. A key part of our statute is providing investigative services for a fee. Investigative services are all-encompassing. There's a lot of different things people do. These are the main ones that we've come across so far. So it depends on if they are, you know, finding out the who, what, where, when, why, and how of a certain situation. What specifically that might be could be many things.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Cook. Then do we do a public information thing to let people know that they need to do this? Because I would have to believe that there's some folks out there that have no idea if they're going to charge to go into a computer and recover some data, or that they may need to have this type of a license.
Right. Director Cook.
Mr. Chair, Representative, while we do have, you know, listed on our website our statutes and our rules, I don't know how we would go about informing other people that might be interested in doing this. We're obviously available to contact if they want. It is something that the board and I have discussed. We've discussed it with law enforcement. We've worked with the Fusion Center on putting out some law enforcement briefs to inform the law enforcement community. Our board has sent out some information to county attorneys, but you know, it's kind of incumbent upon the person that's looking to get into this business to make sure that they're you know, working within the statutes.
Okay, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually reading through this when you were talking. Did you say that there are some of the training you don't charge for?
Director Cook. Mr. Chair, Representative. Currently, we do not charge for training. That is correct. There is actually in our statutes where any training fees have to be made by rule, by an administrative rule. Well, I've never been through the rule-changing process, but I hear it's pretty arduous and expensive. I've heard numbers between 40 and 70,000, and we simply don't have the money right now to initiate that type of rule change. It is a lot of money that we're missing out on, and we do spend a lot of resources in reviewing this training material.
Representative Fossadin.
I guess that is what I was getting at. It sounds like that, and these are private enterprises. They're not government entities. I guess I'm wondering why we aren't charging for the training. And Mr. Chair, you know more about that than I do. You any ideas?
None whatsoever.
Okay.
Did Walt, you got anything to any reason? Why haven't we in the past, Director Cook, do you know?
Mr. Chair, Representative, as stated, the rule changes take money, and we do not have enough money in our budget to conduct the rule change at this time. It is, we have discussed it, and we found that for the amount of money we might be charging compared to what the cost of a rule change might be, it just isn't feasible at this time.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What kind of money are we talking about?
We haven't really had a serious discussion on what we would charge per training. As you can see, some of our license fees are rather high. I wouldn't see charging that much. But we'd have to do an analysis, and I'm sure a physical note, to really determine what the resources take on average for reviewing some of these training programs. And it's really the amount of time. It all comes down to units of time of staff actually reviewing the training material.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Cook, for coming here. We hear a lot of organizations, a lot of agencies come before this committee at the beginning of every legislative cycle. We are inundated with information. On behalf of some of the newer members and also some of us older ones that occasionally have memory issues, I'm going to ask you two questions. In your opinion, what's the one takeaway? Because as we go through this throughout the legislative year and you get kind of mixed into that blizzard of issues that we have to cover, give me one thing one thing that you want us to take away from today, from what you have to say, what's one thing you want us to remember?
Director Cook?
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, thank you very much for the question. Well, obviously, besides the importance of our industry in assisting law enforcement, I think right now that we're still in a reactive stage. In other words, as we're going through renewals every 2 years, we're finding out things that happened in the past, and we're putting together the pieces of the puzzle for the board to implement disciplinary action, whatever it is. I would like to see our agency more on the enforcement side, being more proactive, but that might take another position, such as an auditor or an investigator, to do that.
Okay, Representative Newberg.
Thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, just wondering, your packet says that the agency has appropriated $189,000 annually and then all revenue is deposited in general fund. What's the revenue amount? I may just have missed it in your presentation, but sort of how much comes back in, I gather, from license fees paid?
Director Cook.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can actually give you more of an exact number from our last budget cycle. I can tell you on average it bounces around between $150,000 a year. So for fiscal year 2016, it was $149,000. And fiscal year 2015, it was $123,000. Excuse me, those were disbursements. Fiscal year 2016 was $161,000, and fiscal year 2015 was $172,000.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I gather, if I'm understanding that right, so the amount that is taken in is actually pretty close to the amount that comes out of the general fund to fund operations.
Director?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. And an interesting kind of side point, I've been communicating with the Department of Revenue because I was really interested on the amount of tax revenue that the industry brings into the state. And the first number they gave me was $16 million. But the disclaimer that is they wanted to check over a couple of numbers, so that is not exact, but that's the first number that I got from them.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, just one other item.
President Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, which is just to confirm that the certification and training programs, as I gather, is pretty broad in the sense of making sure, you know, just reviewing the outline, making sure the instructor is qualified, but you're not doing a lot of quality control or content review specifically, and I don't intend that to be a loaded term at all. I mean, the point is just that you're not providing a lot of real in-depth content review. Is that correct?
Director. Mr. Chair, Representative. So when somebody, we have an application that they have to fill out, and along with that application, we request a narrative outline, sometimes the material that is involved. Sometimes I utilize interns who are all college students, and I consider professional sort of class auditors, to when we can go out and actually go to some of these classes. Sometimes if somebody complains that the class wasn't long enough or the quality wasn't bad, I might, you know, discuss it with the instructor or take a closer look. But we just want to make sure that the instructor has some sort of qualifications. He's taught before, maybe he has a train-the-trainer class. Many of our instructors are actually former law enforcement, have extensive history. I have actually had requests from some license holders who are watching videos and want to get credit for it. You know, do that. But we do take a closer look as we can at these courses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative. Okay, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Cook, getting back to the training, is asked about the cost for training. My question is, do you actually do the training or your department, or do you just review the training material to make sure it meets the qualifications for the private detectives over your board?
Director. Mr. Chair, Representative, no, these are professional trainers, training providers. We do not provide the training at all. I do regional meetings, and I do teach some things, and we have board meetings, we teach some things, but this is a sort of a separate industry of training that these people come, they apply, they get certified by us.
Representative Johnson.
Just a little pops up. I just was just getting clarification that you're not actually doing the training, but you're reviewing it to make, just like Post Board does with their stuff, they review the trainers, put the stuff together, and you make sure that it's meeting the qualifications.
Director?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Okay, any more questions, anyone? Representative Constantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but you pay for the training. You pay those people, or you don't.
Director?
The ones that Mr. Johnson was talking, Representative Johnson was talking.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do not pay the trainers. They charge a fee to the license holders for their courses. They're a separate business.
And then,
So are there any costs to you for the training?
Director, Mr. Chair, Representative, there's no monetary cost. The only cost, again, comes in resources as far as units of time and reviewing the material.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, okay. Representative Johnson.
And then, Representative Constantine, about your other question, that I think the agencies, the state agencies, when they do the rulemaking, it's in their budget but not as a line item. I mean, they use their budget, but it's not a line item. Is that correct, Mr. Walls? I mean, the cost of them doing the rulemaking.
Mr. Chair, I'm not an expert on rulemaking. I know on other committees that I've served on, agencies with larger budgets tend to just absorb the cost. I have seen at times small amounts of money put into omnibus bills to pay for rulemaking.
Okay. So that's something we can look at. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in all of this, but it's a fairly small board, and I'm not particularly with this particular board, but I have had some constituents express some concern about the ethics involved with professional boards doing evaluations or responding to complaints, and how there tends to be some opportunity for protecting the professional more than paying attention to the client. Or the client who feels that they have been abused or have not gotten the service that they wanted. So I'm asking about your processes in evaluating your professional clients when there's a complaint.
Director?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the complaint process is fairly arduous. A lot of the complaints we get in that regard, and by the way, we really do not get a lot of complaints. It's really gone down the last couple of years. We've only received a couple. We've had in the past a complaint committee. Right now we're looking at actually not having that, and the board's just going to be dealing with that directly. But to answer your question, a lot of the complaints are, for example, a client pays a private investigator to find out some sort of information. Private investigator may do their due diligence, and they're really just paying for that investigator to search for it. They might not find it, but they've tried to, and if they don't come up with the answer the client wants, they're unhappy about it and they want their money back. The way the complaint committee has looked at that is that's more of a civil sort of situation that should be handled in small claims court. In our statutes, really it comes down to the license holders need to make sure they're communicating with the client, so on and so forth. But if it comes to money issues or business transaction, they look at that as a civil sort of issue that should be handled in small claims court. If it's criminal activity, the board would want to wait until the case has gone through the court system and a conviction has happened before they would take an action on it.
Okay, if there's no more questions, thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. Cook.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Next up, we have the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, Robert Small, Executive Director.
Hey, how you doing?
How you doing? Technological problems, Mr. Small?
No, I just didn't want to throw away this very expensive computer that's not mine.
Oh, okay. Director Small, go ahead and begin, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Small, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. First, I want to thank you for the opportunity to address the committee and tell you a little bit about our association and give you an overview. With me today, although not here at the table, is Nancy Haas, our longtime lobbyist. Ms. Haas is with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer, is probably known to many of you. Our president is Jeff Edblatt, who is the Isanti County Attorney, and he would want to have been with us today, but he's in court up in Isanti County. Mr. Ed Blatt has been the Isanti County Attorney since 1994. He also served as a member of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission from 2003 to 2016, and he served as the chair from 2007 to 2015. In our association, he had a number of executive positions before he was elected as the president this past December. Ms. Haas, she's been the lead lobbyist for our association since 2006. And as far as my background is concerned, I was a prosecutor for 25 years with the United States Attorney's Office. I was an assistant United States Attorney. I was the first assistant United States Attorney, and then I was also the interim United States Attorney between President Clinton and President Bush. After serving as an assistant United States Attorney for all those years, I was appointed a judge in the Hennepin County District Court, where I served for just short of 9 years. I reached mandatory retirement. I reached mandatory retirement in November of 2014, and I served up to the November 30th, and then I started this job on December 1st of 2014 because retirement didn't exactly fit my bill. So most of you then will see either Ms. Haas or I or me around the Capitol here. The County Attorneys Association consists of over 800 people, the 87 elected county attorneys as well as their assistants. Our governing body consists of 29-member board of directors. Those members are equally spread among the 10 judicial districts throughout the state. Informally, we've been around since Minnesota became a state in 1858, and county attorneys have been talking to each other. But formally, in 1973, the legislature created the Minnesota County Attorneys Council, which consisted of the 87 elected county attorneys as well as the attorney general. The legislation set forth the mission of the council, and that was to strengthen the criminal justice system in Minnesota. And they were to do that by providing leadership on legal and public policy issues related to the duties of the county attorneys, to provide training and continuing legal education for our attorneys and our law enforcement partners, to gather and disseminate information to our attorneys about legislative enactments and any other changes in the law, and lastly, to coordinate with law enforcement, the courts, corrections, and others by providing seminars to augment the effectiveness of the criminal justice system. The County Attorneys Association, in its current form, was formally created as a not-for-profit corporation in 1977, and for a variety of reasons, the council and the association essentially merged shortly thereafter. The mission of the association, however, has remained the same as was the mission of the council. So there are times that we will appear before you to actively seek legislation. For example, during the last legislative session, we worked with our law enforcement partners, with defense lawyers, with public interest groups, to affirmatively work with the legislature to obtain the passage of the 2016 Drug Reform Act. A couple of years ago, we worked with the legislature to increase training funds for the county attorneys to provide that training portion of our mission to county attorneys, law enforcement, and other stakeholder partners. Indeed, this session you will see a $100,000 item on the budget for prosecutor and law enforcement training, and that's what that's all about. This session, because of changes to the child protection laws that were enacted a number of years ago, and those laws significantly increased the responsibilities of assistant county attorneys doing child protection work, getting them involved much earlier in the process. We will be seeking additional funding to assure that we can have adequate resources to meet those responsibilities. We will also be monitoring, as part of the 2016 Drug Reform Act, you may recall that there was a Justice Reinvestment Fund created, and we will be monitoring that Justice Reinvestment Funding that was created last session and making sure that adequate funding gets in there. More often, however, we see ourselves as resources for legislators on the multitude of issues that you face as you go about carrying out your responsibilities. An example of that, within the past couple of months, the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission was proposing a change in the guidelines that was related to the 2016 Drug Reform Act. And our association and law enforcement disagreed with the proposal, and we were pleased that Representative Johnson and Representative Cornish agreed with our position and provided assistance in opposing the change to the guidelines, and the guidelines proposal failed in December. Also, as I mentioned earlier, our mission does include providing leadership on legal and public policy issues related to the duties of the county attorneys. The duties of the county attorneys, as you know, are set forth in Chapter 388 of our statute. And summarizing them, they include acting as the legal advisor to the county commissioners, to county officials and other county departments, to prosecute felony crimes, to prosecute all cases involving juvenile offenders, to provide assistance and support to the victims and witnesses who play a vital role in our criminal justice system, and to provide assistance in family service cases, that is child protection, protection of vulnerable adults, civil commitments to provide necessary treatment for individuals who are mentally ill and or chemically dependent, and for families that are receiving public assistance to obtain and enforce child support obligations or to establish paternity of a child. So those are among the duties of the county attorney. With respect to each of these duties, our association has a committee structure, and for each of these duties, we have a committee comprising of county attorneys and their assistants who are experts in that particular subject matter. When a bill is introduced that may have an impact on the duties of the county attorney, it is reviewed by our relevant committee, and a recommendation to the entire board is made, and that's the position that you will hear Nancy and I talking about. So if there's any legal or public policy issues in any of these areas that I mentioned, we're available to each of you as a resource. As examples, when there is a bill affecting civil forfeiture laws, we arrange a meeting between the author of the bill and two assistant county attorneys who work in that specific area, and we arrange a meeting to discuss the particulars of the bill and how that might have some practical impacts on the day-to-day work of the assistant county attorneys. And from that, there was significant adjustments to the bill. Another example, you may recall, there was a bill that was introduced to establish procedures for the family of a decedent who may have religious objections to the performance of an autopsy by the medical examiner. We work closely with the various stakeholders and the legislators to craft language that resolved uncertainty regarding the grounds on which a person could make a religious objection and how that religious objection would be processed. Significantly, we came to an agreement with all the stakeholders and the legislators to define what a compelling state interest might be and when it might exist to perform an autopsy. So that's a quick overview of what we do. That's a quick overview, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that the members might have.
Questions, members? We must have done a very good job.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it, and the computer's good here.
Thank you, Director Small. Okay, well, now we go into Civil Legal Services Overview, and we've got two names. If you would, whoever would like to begin, give your name and title so we can sort you out.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you so much for having us here today. I'm Kathy Hockadall, and I am the Executive Director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. And I will ask Ann Hupkin, the Executive Director of Northwest Minnesota Legal Services, to start while I'm trying to get our computer to come back up.
Okay, go ahead, ma'am.
Good morning. Thank you. Again, my name is Ann Hupkin. I'm the Executive Director of Legal Services of Northwest Minnesota. So my organization represents low-income clients in the aptly named Northwest part of the state, 22 rural counties, about 24,000 square miles. And I am here to briefly, and I will emphasize briefly, tell a short story about a client, a civil legal aid client that was recently represented in Northwest Minnesota, to put a face to some of the numbers and some of the background that Kathy's going to give to the committee in a moment. So the client I want to talk about today is a woman in her mid-70s. Is a woman in her mid-70s who, after nearly 50 years of marriage, was living on her own for the first time. And she was living on her own because she had moved her husband into the veterans home. He had reached a point in his dementia that she could no longer safely care for him at home. So she moved him into the veterans home, and she was renting an apartment. As she began renting, she noticed a black substance on a couple of the walls. She reached out to the landlord wondering what that black substance was. She was concerned about mold. She was concerned about her health and respiratory issues. And the landlord said, well, it's probably something you did from cooking, so I will charge you. I'll paint it, but I'll charge you for the paint. She agreed. She paid $250 to have the apartment repainted. A few months passed by. The black substance reappeared. And she brought in the health inspector, and she was, again, concerned for her own health. So she took some initiative on her own, brought in the health inspector, and the health inspector said, this isn't mold, it's a soot from the baseboard heat. And the landlord said to the health inspector and the building inspector, can you put in your report that it's the landlord's, that it's the tenant's fault, that she did something, this isn't my fault. And at this point, the elderly woman was directed to our office. A lawyer stepped in and started working with her on how you ask your landlord to make repairs, what's the right way to do it. And she started following that process. Meanwhile, the landlord didn't like this troublemaker, and so he filed an eviction, found a petty reason to file an eviction, and she was facing eviction. So in 7 days, because an eviction process, you are served, and 7 days later is the hearing, she was facing homelessness, and so she called the attorney she was working with in a bit of a panic. And our attorney was able to work through... Sorry, I'm just slightly distracted by this. not to be distracted. So she worked with the attorney in our office to negotiate a settlement. And she was able to get a move-out date. She was able to not pay the remainder of the lease. The landlord said, fine, you can move out, but you got to pay the 6 months. She lives on a fixed income. She wasn't able to pay double rent for 6 months. Our attorney was able to work a move-out agreement, enabling her to get a safe, affordable home in a location near the veterans home so she could visit her husband. It avoided an eviction. The court avoided at least two hearings of a contested eviction hearing. It added to the efficiency of the system, and it saved this elderly woman a lot of stress, and it saved her husband a lot of stress as well, as he was concerned for her. So this isn't the biggest case that happened in Minnesota last year, and it's probably not even the biggest case that happened in Northwest Minnesota. But it's just an example of the clients that we serve and how civil legal aid, and I know Kathy will talk about this a little bit in a moment, serves the efficiency of the court system, helping low-income clients and, again, helping the court system. Thank you. I think she's ready to go.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I apologize for the fact that you do not have our PowerPoint presentation. As you can see, this is not an expensive piece of computer equipment. It went out and won't seem to reboot for me. So I apologize for that, but I think you do perhaps have the PowerPoint in your materials, and we would also be happy to send it to you. Thank you so much again for having us in the committee. We've had the pleasure of meeting with some of you, and I hope to meet with the rest of you. I know some of you know a bit about civil legal services. In addition to Ms. Hupkin, we have the other executive directors of the regional programs here today with us. What we do is a unique service in the state of Minnesota to provide the most vulnerable in our community with legal services that help them access the basic necessities for safety, shelter, and economic security. Starting at slide three, if you're following in the materials, we provide free legal help to people with civil legal problems. We do not do any criminal law. And as I say, we help people access their most basic needs. We work with volunteer attorneys to leverage our resources, and we contribute to safety and stability for families across Minnesota. We serve people in all 87 counties of our state. We promote safety and stability in families. We help seniors and people with disabilities. Those are a lot of our clients. And we contribute to the core judicial branch goal of access to justice by helping keep the judicial system efficient, by providing help to people who have meritorious claims in court so there are fewer self-represented litigants, and by also keeping people out of court when that is not a good solution, because we tell people if they don't have a case and help them resolve their problem, perhaps another way through referral, or just simply understand that they don't have a case and it's a waste of their time to go to court as well. We believe in innovation and we work hard to promote it across the state. We were the original partners with the county attorney in St. Cloud in Stearns County to establish the Stearns County Domestic Violence Court Partnership. This is not a court established by the court system like the drug courts or veterans courts. These are partnerships between the county attorney and legal aid programs in the state to reduce recidivism among felony-level offenders and to help more women victims, typically women, to leave their abuser permanently, and our data shows that we have accomplished both of those goals. The success of the Stearns County program has led to the establishment of about five other domestic violence court projects across the state, and we would like to establish even more when we have an opportunity to do so. We've also established as a network a number of medical legal partnerships across the state. These are nationally recognized as a way to improve health outcomes for people by providing a legal aid attorney on site at a medical provider so that they can get referrals on legal issues that relate to people's health, such as domestic violence, bad repaired, mold in housing, as was discussed in Ms. Hopkins' example, and similar legal issues that actually affect health. We have six regional programs that blanket the whole state, and those are the folks that are with me. We also have a number of smaller partners that provide very targeted services, maybe pro bono programs, single county services on very targeted matters. And all of our funding comes through the Supreme Court by grants. We are a line item in the Supreme Court's budget, and that money is granted out by the Supreme Court to this network of programs. We deliver every kind of legal service that a lawyer typically does. We represent people in court. We also do a great deal of advice, consultation, and negotiation, such as the example given by Ms. Hufkin. That's actually the bulk of the matters we take. We only go to court if that's the last resort, because obviously going to court uses resources that we try to be very good stewards of. We provide a great deal of community legal education around the state to tens of thousands of people on all of the legal issues that we practice on, and we provide web-based services. We've developed the Law Help MN website. It was one of the first in the country to provide several dozen low-literacy fact sheets on a multitude of legal issues that are available to anyone, not just our clients, obviously. And there is a live chat feature on the website that we operate during business hours to help people navigate the site if they're having trouble doing so. In 2014, we served almost, that's the last year for which we have statewide data, because the Supreme Court only collates it every other year, so we will have the 2016 data soon, and we certainly will provide it at our budget hearing, or before if you'd like it. In 2014, we served almost 47,000 Minnesotans, and we do have an income. We prioritize by income and by the legal issues. There's only certain legal issues, obviously, we help with. We don't do personal injury work, for example. We don't do employment discrimination. Those are areas of law that are addressed by the private bar. We also evaluate all of the calls we get for merit. We want to be good stewards of our money and not take on clients who don't have a legitimate claim. The major areas that we practice law in are family law. Almost all of our family law clients, this is one of them, are victims of domestic violence. That is how we prioritize that work. That's about a quarter of our cases. Another quarter is housing. Again, it's people who are imminently about to lose their shelter due to illegal eviction or have a very serious repairs problem such that they can't advocate for themselves on, such as the one Ms. Hufkin described. And then the third category, that's also about a quarter, is economic stability, protecting people from consumer fraud. This is a particular problem. These has been for a number of years for seniors who are victims of financial and other scams, and also accessing basic supports for food and health care, et cetera. About two-thirds of our clients are women, because that is the disparity that exists in poverty across the country. And about 20% of our clients are seniors, which is another group that is disproportionately in poverty in our state and across the country. Most of the cases are closed by our full-time or part-time attorneys who are with all of our programs, our staff programs, but about a third of the cases we close every year are closed by our volunteers. All of our programs have significant volunteer attorney programs, which we're very thankful for. We still turn a lot of people away. We do an unable to serve study every 2 years. We did one in 2016, and of the eligible people who actually called us, we turned away 60% of them. And that means eligible both by income and eligible by the kind of legal issue they present that we actually do. We try to provide those people with referrals, but frankly, if we can't help them as a lawyer, there's probably no one else who will. And in Minnesota, there is one private attorney for every 365 potential paying clients. Some may say that's too many lawyers in the state of Minnesota, but regardless of that, I think the interesting contrast is that there is one legal aid attorney for every 4,000 low-income individuals with legal problems. As I mentioned before, we are a line item in the Supreme Court budget, and that's why we appear before you. In addition, there are two other sources of state-administered funding that the Supreme Court grants out. They do it all at one time every other year. One is called interest on lawyers' trust accounts, which is client monies that lawyers have to have deposited in banks. And the other is the attorney registration fee. There's a part of that that goes to the Supreme Court for civil legal services. Lawyers have to renew their registration every year. We have money from everywhere we can possibly try to get it. Almost 40% is the state-administered funding that I've talked about. And another approximately 33% is other federal and local funding sources that we get grants and contracts for. And then the remainder is United Way's foundations and private donations. We all work hard to raise money from a variety of sources, and the private bar has been very supportive, law firms and individuals. But clearly the state appropriation is very significant for us, and we appreciate your support over the years. We leverage the resources we get in as many ways as possible. One way is to increase technological access for our clients and for the general public. As I talked about the Law Help website, we also have a website that supports all of the volunteer attorneys across the state, and we have now online intake that's available statewide and online legal advice. These are two projects we've developed in the past couple of years. We leverage by having volunteer attorneys. The staff programs are really the infrastructure for the volunteer attorneys. We train them, we mentor them, we match them up with clients. But frankly, obviously, we couldn't do as much work as we do without them. And the state funds are critical for us accessing a lot of the federal money we get, because most of the federal contracts we have require a match from unrestricted funds. So, for example, we get my program has a grant from a contract with the IRS to help low-income taxpayers, and that requires a 50% match from other funds. We track outcomes for our clients, both the money we are able to obtain and protect from them and the number of people who achieve safety, are able to find or keep a job, or have improved housing conditions, for example. We also just, and I know you have this, I'm not sure if everybody has the PowerPoint, but we're going to provide it to you, I assure you. We also just on Friday released an economic impacts report of legal aid. It's the first that has ever been done in Minnesota. And what we had a volunteer economist to do this using a template that has been used, paid for by other legal aid programs in the country, but we were able to use it without charge. And what the economists determined is that for every dollar invested in legal aid in Minnesota, there is a $3.94 return on the investment in either money that directly goes back into the economy through income that is protected or obtained for our clients, or through avoided costs of domestic violence and homelessness, or through leveraging the resources I talked about before. You will see an increase requested by us. There are briefly three reasons for that. One is that our salaries are the lowest in the public sector for attorneys, and we have, since the market has improved a bit, we are really losing attorneys at the kind of the 5 to 9 year level who can go make more money working for the public defender, the county attorney, or judicial clerkships. This is a very difficult way to serve 47,000 people a year when you have too much turnover in that particular range of attorneys. In addition, while our resources, our financial resources have been flat, our fixed costs have been rising, particularly health insurance, which has made it, obviously, we have less net income. And finally, we want to continue our developments in technology, because that is really a way we can help a lot of people that we cannot directly advise and represent. And it also benefits the entire public, those folks who really don't qualify for our services but still have a lot of difficulty accessing an attorney. As I said, we blanket the whole state. There's a map in the materials that shows how we're divided up and gives you our contact information. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just for everybody's benefit, do you have a number on what, an average salary would be for an attorney starting out working for one of your organizations? I know it would vary based on what part of the state, but just so people have an idea of how low they're actually paid.
Right. The starting, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative. We have a ballpark. You're right. We are a bunch of nonprofits, so we have our own boards of directors. But actually, it's not too dissimilar among the large regional programs. And the average starting salary is $46,000, and it hardly goes up at all. It goes up like $500 to $1,000 a year from there.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine's more of a comment. Having worked in the jail and seen how people try to handle their own legal affairs, I think the service that they provide that is probably the most useful is the fact that low-income people can come in and ask some questions and get pointed in the right direction instead of going into court completely ignorant of what they're trying to do and then clog up the court. It's really a great service to have for them just to get pointed in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, so just a comment building on that, I'm noticing you've got this these benefits that are secured in different categories on this graphic, showing that almost $4 in return for every $1 invested. I noticed, though, that none of these categories includes the savings for the court system for people who don't receive this kind of help, because not only is that a challenge for them, but it's a real problem and really, as Representative Considine says, clogs up the work and causes all kinds of problems and additional costs, I think, elsewhere if you didn't exist. Any comment on that?
Mr. Chair, sure. Representative Pinto, we do believe that we have that benefit, but we tried to do, number one, a very conservative report with numbers that we could rely clearly on and that our economists would rely on. And we did not have data that would allow us to incorporate the courts. In fact, if you see the larger report, it indicates that savings to the court system are specifically not included in the report.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
But I guess I just want to confirm, although they maybe can't be quantified, in your experience, they seem like they'd be pretty real and significant. Would you agree?
Mr. Chair.
Director.
Representative Pinto. Yes, and I believe the courts would agree. We help them be more efficient because, obviously, if an attorney is there with someone, it moves along much more easily than if it's a self-represented litigant. And in addition, we do keep people out of the courthouse. We are very frank with people if they do not have a legal problem. And one might assume that, well, they'll just go off anyway. But the fact is they actually don't. They feel like they've been heard. They understand why they don't have a case. The other thing we're able to do often with folks that we can't represent is send them to either the court self-help desk or the library. We have a lot of folks who work in libraries across the state, both the law libraries that the courts have, but also we have either attorneys or volunteers all across the state in law libraries where people can come in and get some direction about how to fill out certain forms. A lot of court proceedings are very form driven. So that's another way that we're able to keep people from clogging up the system.
Thank you.
All right. Members, any more questions? If not, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you, and I apologize again for the failure of this technology that we clearly need to improve.
Okay. And now we have Mr. Kyer and Mr. Ward, Chief Administrator and State Public Defender, the Board of Public Defense Overview. Welcome, gentlemen, and whoever wants to start, give your name and title and begin. We've got a whole mess of slides here, folks, so if we can be frugal with our questions and finish by noon, it'd be great.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. Next to me is Bill Ward, our State Public Defender. You do have a whole mess of slides. Some of them we are going to spend a little more time on. Some we will go through rather quickly. We know that you might be a little pressed for time. Mr. Chairman and members, our federal and state constitutions both provide for representation when somebody's an offender and is potentially loses their liberty. Minnesota statutes also provide for representation in some instances, and we'll talk a little bit about this later in the presentation. The most famous of these cases on that is Gideon versus Wainwright, which I think most of you have either heard about or read, if those of you who are lawyers. in Minnesota, starting on page 4, it's the Board of Public Defense that is responsible for providing representation to folks in criminal cases. The board is an independent board within the judicial branch. We have 4 members who are appointed by the Supreme Court. We have 3 members who are appointed by the governor. Their job or their responsibilities are outlined in Minnesota Statute 611.215. They set the standards and the policy for our public defender system. They appoint our chief public defenders and our appellate defender, and they allocate funding from the legislature. We are organized into three programs. Excuse me, you can see this beginning on page 6. Our district public defense, our appellate office, and our administrative services office. Back in 2011, the board held a planning session and came up with five major goals of the public defender system. And these are much more detailed than our own materials, but just to very quickly, the five are continual training for all staff, creative advocacy, being a full partner in the justice system, and I know that Director Small has talked a little bit about that. We're, in terms of the county attorneys as resources, over the years we have been a resource for a number of you on this committee on policy issues, particularly the state public defender and our district chief public defenders. Recruitment and retention of excellent staff, and finally, and most importantly, client-centered representation, and we're going to talk a little bit about that later on in our budget presentation. The board has set service priorities as well. Those are outlined on page 8 of your handout. Back in 2008, we went through a severe budget crisis. We lost 15% of our staff, and there were just things that we weren't able to do or able to accomplish. The board set priorities at that time that are still in place. It is in-custody clients, constitutionally mandated services, statutory services for in-custody clients, constitutionally mandated service for out-of-custody clients, and then statutory mandated services for out-of-custody clients. Of those six items on page 8, we only get down to about number 4. There's nothing that our folks do that isn't either mandated by Constitution or by statute. As I mentioned, one of our programs is the District Public Defense. That's on page 9 of your handout. We provide constitutionally mandated services in felony, gross misdemeanor and others cases, misdemeanor cases, and juvenile delinquency cases. The other cases, but for the most part, are probation violations, extradition hearings, those types of things. We also provide services for children over 10 in child protection cases, and that's a statutory mandate that we have. Roughly 80 to 90% of the felony cases that you see come through the court system, the folks are represented by a public defender. About 60 to 65% of the misdemeanor and gross misdemeanors clients will have a public defender. Those numbers typically have not changed over the years, and as we have talked to our colleagues across the country, they are pretty standard for most states or most large county programs. Our appellate office provides service in criminal appeals, post-conviction proceedings, and supervised release proceedings, or what you might refer to them as parole revocation hearings. The post-conviction proceedings typically are where there are sentence modifications, where there are potential errors at the trial level, where there are evidence issues potentially at the trial level. On page 11 of your handout, we also have a slide. We administer a grant program for public defense corporations under Minnesota Statute 611.215. There are four public defense corporations in the state of Minnesota that we administer those funds for. They handle about 4,000 cases a year that, but for their existence, would be public defender cases. These four are the Minneapolis Legal Rights Center, the St. Paul Neighborhood Justice Center, Duluth Indian Legal Services, and the Regional Native Public Defense Corporation, which provides services on the White Earth and Leech Lake reservations. Most of these, in fact, all four of them, actually, in one way or another, actually predate a state system of public defense. Excuse me. We have 9 judicial public defender offices or central offices. a few years ago, I think some of you may recall, we combined the administration of the 7th and 8th Judicial Districts. We have the Appellate Office, as I mentioned, which is just down the street here on University Avenue, 17 satellite offices, and approximately 200 part-time defenders. The part-time defenders make up about 40% of our staff. They make up about 50% of our staff outside of the metropolitan area. For 2017, we have a budget of roughly $82 million. On page 14 of that handout, you can see where that goes. About 90% of the budget is personnel. About 6% of it is mandated costs. When we talk about mandated costs, we talk about things like rent, data lines, mileage, phone lines, those things that we have some kind of contractual obligation for. We have approximately 820 staff members. That includes staffing in Hennepin and Ramsey counties. Those of you who have been around for a while recall that we continue to have county employees in Hennepin and Ramsey. Those folks were grandfathered in when a state system of public defense was implemented back in the early 1990s. So, excuse me, all of those folks who were hired prior to January 1st of 1999 remained county employees. All of the folks hired after that period are state employees, including our part-timers. I do want to visit, Mr. Chairman, a little bit about our part-time defenders. They are obviously, as I said, about 50% of our staff in the outside of the metropolitan area. They are really kind of the backbone of our process out in greater Minnesota. They're state employees. They work either 75, 50, or 25% time for us. They take whatever cases are assigned to them, but for a small stipend that we give them, it's about $4,000 for a three-quarter time public defender, they cover their own office overhead. Those of you who are attorneys and run an office or are interns in an office, you know that that doesn't even scratch the surface of what it costs to run a law firm. As I said, they are majority of defenders or close to majority of defenders outside of the metro area. These are local attorneys, small businessmen and women, obviously have some other private work that they do. The other thing that they do, that they put in about 35 to 40,000 hours a year that they don't get paid for. They get paid a lump sum from us, and as I mentioned, they take whatever cases come to them. If they're in trial for a week or two, they don't get any more money than if they're not in trial or if they're pleading those cases out. So these folks are really dedicated people. They're dedicated to their craft, obviously. They're dedicated to our mission. I will tell you, we don't pay them a great deal. But what we have, and I know you heard this earlier, is they do get insurance through the state insurance program, and that is a big, big hook that we have for them to keep them in our fold and keep them doing this work. And as you all know, because you're dealing with insurance, these health insurance issues, availability, quality, and cost are huge, huge issues, and this has just been a godsend, frankly, for us that we've been able to do that for these folks. So, Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned previously, we are the largest user of the court system. We have about 143,000 cases on the trial level, roughly 3,900 appellate files. Those are not all cases that are filed, but they are cases that come in the door. Roughly 3,800 parole violation or supervised release cases that are handled. And again, providing mandated services in every courthouse in the state of Minnesota. On page 18, you can see that, and why this is important is there are two Supreme Court cases from our Minnesota State Supreme Court that have determined that public defenders cannot refuse cases. And Mr. Chairman, those who have been around for a while have heard me use this analogy before. It's kind of like the potholes on I-94 between Minneapolis and St. Paul. If there are 15 of those or 20 of those potholes and the DOT only has money to fix 10 of them, we swerve around the other ones. If we've got 20 clients sitting in the hallway waiting for a public defender, that public defender doesn't have the advantage of saying, you know what, the last five of you in line I'm not going to get to today, or the last five of you in line, you're going to come back tomorrow. We don't have that ability. We can't refuse cases. Why that's important is that at the same time, our lawyers are held to the same ethical standards that any of the private lawyers are. On page 19 of the handout, there are three important United States Supreme Court cases that are critically important to not only our clients but our lawyers, essentially saying that the criminal defendants have a Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel in plea negotiations, and that immigration consequences are also part of that. Those are huge, huge issues for our folks in terms of knowing what those are, in terms of informing clients, and having a real discussion with the clients about what those consequences are. As I said, Mr. Chairman, we have about 143,000 cases a year. On page 20, you can see the breakdown of the cases. Roughly a third of them are misdemeanor cases. If you turn to the next page, what we do as an organization is we break this down into case units. Our lawyers do a multitude of cases. They do felony, they do misdemeanor, they do juveniles. Excuse me. So we broke it into a case unit. A case unit is approximately equal to a misdemeanor. And on page 21, you can see how that kind of changes the workload, if you will. The felonies now account for the workload of about a third. Right now, our lawyers are handling somewhere between 580 to close to 600 case units per year. So roughly, if you think of it in misdemeanor terms, 575, 580 misdemeanors a year. Our appellate office, Mr. Chairman, if you look at page 22, I know a number of you have been involved in the issues about our prison population. That is the population our appellate office deals with. And as you can see on page 22, those numbers have increased dramatically over the last 4 years and have for a number of years, frankly. It's really related, obviously, to the numbers of folks that we are sending to prison. It's also related to the collateral consequences and the increased sentences that folks have. Folks want to have you take a look at these issues. And it also has been an issue of, at the trial level, of clients feeling like they're not being heard or not having their story told. This has improved greatly in the last couple of bienniums, and we're going to talk a little bit about that as we get through the budget hearing. But one of the big factors in terms of whether somebody appeals their case or, frankly, whether somebody accepts the resolution of their case at the trial level tends to be whether or not their story has been heard. And that's a big, big issue for those clients. In order to do that, the lawyers have to have time to get to know that client, be able to hear their story, be able to understand it, and then, frankly, be able to tell the court about that story. It's one of the ways that we've talked about in our own organization about client-centered representation is how do we tell that story and get it there, not only for the good of the client, but for the good of everybody so that those cases aren't coming back on a post-conviction proceeding, they're not coming back on an appeal, that somebody's actually going to fulfill the terms of their probation or their sentence because they actually felt like they were heard. As I mentioned, Mr. Chairman, we cannot refuse cases. Our public defenders cannot refuse cases. Likewise, all of our workload is determined really by outside factors. If you turn to page 26 in your handout, a number of years ago, the legislative auditor did a program evaluation of the public defender system. and it determined that the most immediate cause of high public defender workloads was the staffing cuts that we sustained in 2008 and 2009. The other ones are really ones that have developed over the last number of years. When we talk about case units, that standard was developed a number of years ago before there was the use of DNA. If you look on page 28 and 29, you can see some of what we are dealing with in terms of increased use of DNA for property crimes, for cold case files. We have now a number of labs in the state, including one up in Andover, that now added a fourth technician to that lab. And we're not here to argue that you shouldn't be doing those things, but those are things that all take time. Those are things that all complicate the defense of these cases and are, frankly, all the issues that have to be reviewed in these cases. That lab in Andover, I took a shot of a Star Tribune article and said that it's funded at $1.7 million a year. Our expert witness budget in the 10th Judicial District is probably $25,000, maybe $30,000 a year. So those are the kinds of things that we're dealing with. On page 30, alcohol and drug issues and a mental health issue. I know we've talked to a number of you already about those issues. Just the increase in the numbers of folks that we see that either have one of those two issues or a lot of times have a dual diagnosis. They have both of those issues. And I know you all have been struggling with those issues. And our folks do as well because we're representing them. The use of computer and electronic forensics. Cell phones, social media, smartphones, computers, all of those things that, again, were 15 years ago were and nothing, or even 10 years ago were nothing that we envisioned that would complicate some of these criminal issues. The use of body cams. Again, we're not here to say they shouldn't or shouldn't be, should or should not be used. But all of them, all of that material must be viewed if it's going to be introduced as evidence. We have issues of storage. I know you all are struggling with some of those issues, or your local police departments are struggling with those issues. And it takes a lot of time. A number of years ago, there was a study done in our pellet office when they wanted to go to audio transcripts. It takes about 3 or 4 times as much time to view a videotape or listen to an audio tape as it does for a lawyer to read a transcript. Particularly on the appellate level, as they're reading those, they're looking for key words and key phrases, those kinds of things. Again, we're not here to tell you they shouldn't be used, that we're against them. We're just here to tell you it does create some problems for us. Cultural changes. We all know Minnesota's changing. We have cultural issues, language issues. We have more and more folks who are coming to us that don't have English as their first language. You know, we have to have interpreters. We have to pay for those interpreters when they're outside of the courtroom. So that, again, is another one of those factors. Federal and state. Local funding decisions. Every once in a while you will read where the feds have provided a county with money for DWI enforcement or cold cases or whatever it might be. Again, those cases end up coming into a system that's already overburdened. Collateral consequences, I mentioned that earlier. We have about 200 collateral consequences in the state of Minnesota. Again, not for every crime and not for every issue, but those lawyers need to be up to speed on those. They need to be talking with their clients about that because, again, it becomes potentially a discipline or a licensing issue for them. Ballistics is another one where we've come a long way on the analysis of ballistics. And changes in the private sector. I think I talked to some of you about this before. We had a couple of our tech staff up in St. Cloud, in our St. Cloud office, and they were in the coffee shop down the street from our office. They counted 9 video cameras in the coffee shop in St. Cloud. If there's an incident there, that's now 9 cameras and 9 videos that somebody has has to deal with. I can't imagine how many there are in a Target store or a Home Depot or wherever it might be. So again, those are just changes that our folks have had to deal with. Finally, changes to the court system, Mr. Chairman and members. You have heard me say this before. The most efficient way for us to do our job and for us to store material is paper. It has been, and I frankly don't see that it ever will be any better than that. But we also know that's not the way of the world. But we are having a great deal of difficulty because now everything is electronically filed in the court system. Documents, particularly in our appellate office, that we used to get on paper and in a file or, frankly, even email to us, now somebody has to go in and click each individual document, download it, send it to a printer, bring it back, put the dates and times on it, and then collate those because they don't come out in the correct order. This is a huge, huge issue. We've hired two temporary people to do that work in the appellate office. They spend about half their day doing nothing but downloading and copying files. Again, that's no aspersion on the court. It's no aspersion on anybody. We understand that's the way it is, that the business has changed. But it is a problem for us, and I see it as this rolls out on the trial level, it's going to be a much, much bigger issue for us. Mr. Chairman, with that, we have a few more. I don't know if we've got the time to go through any. We've got a few more slides. Starting on page 42, we do have, and again, as I told you, paper is our most efficient and our best way of doing business. Having said that, we understand that's not the way of the world. We are now embarking on an electronic content management system. And on page 42, you can see a diagram. On the left-hand side of that document is our current case management system. So we can tell you about tasks. We can tell you about cases and time and clients, all of those things. Scheduling is on there. We are in the process and hopefully launching a pilot in Dakota County, or I should say in the First Judicial District, in April, of a content management system, where the prosecutors will be able to either email us or upload their documents on a particular case and will automatically come into our system and show up for the attorney when they pull that file up in our current case management system. As long as the prosecutor has the court file number and it's in the proper place and it's in the proper format, our system will take it. So we've been doing that piecemeal. We have not come to you for additional funding for that, which is why, frankly, it's taken us as long as it has, because we've just kind of patched it together. But that's where, as I said, we are hoping to have our first district go out, start that in April, with the remaining districts to go in over the course of the next 3 or 4 months after that. We have not done anything with audio and video yet. We are, frankly, struggling with that issue right now in terms of storage, in terms of bandwidth for our offices. It's one thing to be able to get it, that it's another video. It's another one to be able to pull it down and actually view it and then to store it. So those are some big issues that, frankly, I think we're going to end up coming back to you all with for some type of solution sometime in the future. So, with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm done talking. You can stand for whatever questions you or committee members may have.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is not about your presentation, but about a bill that I would like to see. In my time at the Sheriff's Department, on a routine basis, not all the time, we would have clients picked up in Duluth, Grand Marais, International Falls, would take 2 days of deputy time to go get them. They would come back, and the judge would look at them and go, time served, or released on your own recognizance. There's no provision to take them back. So they would come back to the jail and go, how do I get home? I'd go, I don't know. I have a bill that I would like to be able to use ITV on misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors. Lo and behold, it's already in the court rules. I said, well, why are we having a hang-up on this then? It's the defense attorneys. How do we get you guys on board?
Whichever one you're going.
Yep. Mr. Chair, I'm surprised to hear that they're saying it's the defense attorneys because, Representative Considine, we've worked on this for a long time, willingness to participate in ITV. For many, many years, in the early 2000s, we were against it because the concern was our client was not in court, but yet the prosecutor and the judges were in a different location while we were representing them someplace else. We made a 180-degree about-face on that, and we've been active participants in ITV if it's been requested. So I'm more than happy to talk to you about that individually, but oftentimes what I've been hearing, and I know many of you have too, it's been the bench who does not want to participate in ITV. And a lot of that has to do with what judge is going to hear it, whether they have the capability. In one county, they wanted to charge us to use the ITV facilities in order to even have the communication done by ITV. So I'm more than happy to discuss it. If it's something on our end, I will absolutely address it, but I'd be surprised if it's something that's on our end. It does us no good to have our clients have no way to get home. And ultimately, we collect money and try to find ways to get people back to their home base as a result of what you just pointed out.
Thank you. I'll look forward to talking, and actually just about every other group that I've talked about, I'll point the finger at you guys.
Mr. Chair, that's not surprising, right? Ultimately, it runs downhill, but I'd be surprised if it's on our end.
Okay, members, any questions? You also must have done a fine job of presenting. So you almost got into the budget. We might not even have to ever have a
budget. Well, Mr. Chairman, we do have more to talk about on that.
All right. Yeah, and when you do come back, for the budget, it would be good to bring the comparison to other states and caseloads and salaries, things like that, and how you're spread around in the state. It would be good to know. Thank you much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay, members, if there is nothing else, we're adjourned.